It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett.
Now we react to tragic events, to tragic events like the Washington Naval Yard shooting on Monday can run the gamut from agony to apathy.
Joining us now to talk about how people process emotions, why individuals react differently to tragedy, is Frank Farley, psychologist at Temple University, a former professor here in Wisconsin as well. Frank, thanks for being with us again.
Delighted to be here, Rob.
Well, you've watched a lot of these shootings in the United States, in Canada, and the reaction to them, the aftermath. What types of reactions are you observing in this week's shooting in Washington, D.C.?
Well, from what I can see, you're getting the full gamut. I've seen interviews with relatives and family of victims. There's three broad sort of categories of reaction. One is where you experienced it directly, so you might have been a victim and survived. The other one is you witnessed it. And the third category is you experienced it indirectly, that is, somebody told you about it. So, if we watch television or hear something on the radio describing it, that's that last category. You're experiencing it indirectly. But you can get a gamut of responses. There can be intense fear, helplessness. Some people will say, if only I was there, I could have made a difference. This helplessness, or just sheer terror, horror at what you've seen. So, for example, yesterday there was the bus that crashed into that was hit by a train up in Ottawa, Canada, and witnesses saw the bus driver decapitated in front of them, apparently. And one man was thrown out of the bus and was lying on the ground with both of his legs gone, etc. And so, just the sheer witnessing of these things can strike horror in people. So, again, there's the full gamut. Some of these things last a long time. Some of them can be so serious as to warrant the classification of PTSD. Other ones might simply be what we would call an acute stress disorder. And then other ones are just sort of passing. And, they'll disappear fairly quickly.
Well, it's always a challenge as someone in the media when there's some sort of tragedy and you wonder how much should you cover it? How much is too much? People want to know these things, but are you contributing to the stress of the people in that third category you talked about, the most of us who see things through the lens of the media? Does the way we cover things make people more fearful going forward in their lives?
That's a huge question because Some research suggests that it can make us more fearful. Others that it desensitizes us to violence. It's all over the place, and so it doesn't move us very much. And the final and really heinous category is where it might actually suggest something to someone to do a copycat. They see it, they see this event replayed, and for their own twisted reasons, they model it. They decide to do something like that themselves. So it can desensitize us, or it can make us afraid, or, again, the most heinous outcome might be it gives someone some ideas to do something similar.
These are outlier events. Happily, they're not things that happen each and every day. But given that We do more media coverage of them. As media consumers, we maybe seek out more media coverage of them. Do they loom larger in our minds than they really should?
Oh, I think they do. Yeah. And, I forgot to mention that wonderful old phrase about the media. If it bleeds, it leads. And, they do. What's happening is an isolated, unusual event. I mean, this thing at the Navy Yard is unusual. Against the backdrop of American life, but it gets enormous coverage. And so, yes, it's an exaggeration. And most people's lives will be entirely lived with no contact with such horror. And it's important to keep that in mind. The public has a right to know, of course, but do we need to constantly emphasize the destructive side of human nature? Does that in fact encourage or does it discourage comparable horror? And we don't really have good evidence on that, but, you know, there's no question that the dark side gets more press than the light side of human nature, typically in the news.
I've heard people make the case that you should step away from the coverage sometimes and pay attention to something else, read a book, look at some other news, entertainment news or something like that. Don't dwell, don't keep watching that Twitter feed for every last breaking detail. Is that a personal strategy that you might go for?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the old thing, emphasize the positive, that is so important. And, you know, you only have one life to lead. You want it to be happy, upbeat, positive. All this negative stuff, Zig Ziglar once referred to it as stinking thinking, all this negativity. And, you know, you've got to construct a happy life. And being upbeat and optimistic and positive is a lot better than focusing on the negative.
A healthier too, would you say?
Yes, definitely.
So for people closer to this, now not in that category where most of us are, we saw it from a distance, but people who were witnesses or victims, what kind of help is appropriate for them? I've seen debates back and forth. Do you need immediate talk therapy, or does that just kind of cement the images that you saw that day into your brain? What's the latest state of the art on that?
Well, for a long time, we believed that it was good to have that instant counseling. Now it's debatable. Again, there's not really comprehensive, valid data on this point. But it looks as if for some people, yeah, quick counseling is good, and for other people, it's not good. That is, it simply re-exposes them to the horror. And, you know, they're fighting with it, they're trying to get away from it. And so, personally, I lean toward less counseling rather than more, honestly. That is, you know, if you're going to be constantly dealing with it in the immediate aftermath, it's like you can't get away from this thing. On the other hand, the media is not going to let you get away from it anyway. So that would argue for some degree of counseling to help you separate yourself from this horror. So I think it's a, you know, 50-50, honestly. I think it depends a lot on the person and also the supports the person has in their life, the family supports and the friend supports. You know, if you've got lots of wonderful family and friend supports, maybe you need less of the professional support.
Let's talk about grieving a little. Obviously, people lost loved ones in this event, and people lose loved ones to less dramatic but still equally important events, car accidents, illness. Is there a right way to grieve? How do you talk somebody through that grieving process?
Well, you know, there's a variety of therapeutic approaches to grieving, but, you know, it's, again, very important to have social supports. Loved ones, family, friends. You know, there's growing data showing that loneliness and being, you know, alone in this life shows many of the same qualities as a disease. And there's a fellow named Cacioppo who's written a whole book on loneliness. And he makes a convincing case that, you know, dealing with everything yourself and all alone, et cetera, is extremely dangerous for your health. He claims it's like a disease. So, you know, a very important way, short of getting therapy, is friends and family, loved ones, and having that support system.
We're talking to Frank Farley. He's a psychologist at Temple University, about how we react to mass shootings, what it does to us when we see them in the media, what we think about them. Of course, linked to the shootings in Washington, D.C. on Monday. We want to hear from you. What was your reaction when you heard about the Naval Yard shooting? Are you worried we're becoming desensitized to events like this? Do you think we in the media spend too much time rehashing the events? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can find our Facebook page and post there. That's Central Time on WPR.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time, and we're back now with Frank Farley, psychologist at Temple University. We're taking your calls about reactions to the mass shootings Monday in Washington, D.C. How do you feel when you see news like this? Do you get obsessed? Do you watch the Twitter feed, watch the 24-hour news channels to get every detail, or do you step away for a bit? And how do you feel when you do either of those? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Frank, before we go to the phones, I want to talk about the other side, the motivations behind shootings like this. I don't want to delve too deeply into this week's because obviously there's a lot we don't know yet. But I've talked to a criminal profiler in the past who says, you know what? These are rare enough. It's really hard to profile shootings like this with any accuracy. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely correct. About the only profile we have on rampage killers, mass murderers, etc., is that in general, they're males, they're white, they're between 20 and 40. In this case, Alexis fits the age criterion, the gender criterion, but he's an African-American. But, you know, there are literally millions of people who fit that category. So profiling in mass murders, serial killings, and rampage killings is really not is not scientific at this point. We just don't have much.
The sad part, then, is if it's hard to predict, how do we find people and maybe give them help they need, treatment, alternatives, things that keep them from doing something like this?
Well, I think that my own personal view, by the way, is that almost all of the perpetrators involved in those categories of murder have serious mental problems. Now, lots of people will cry out, yes, but most mentally ill don't kill people, and that is absolutely correct. But I happen to believe that most of these people who do these mass murders do have serious mental problems. So, you know, we just need to get better going forward in tracking, seriously problematic behavior. I mean, this guy is like a poster child for that. I really haven't seen a better case in a long time because there is actually a record. And of all of his serious encounters with authority, with police, his use of firearms under extremely difficult conditions, you know, or shooting at somebody's car or shooting at the apartment above his apartment, and a long litany of these things, and yet he was able to get a gun. Now, he got a shotgun. That's what he went into the naval yard with, and he picked up two other weapons while he was there. But, you know, and a shotgun, you know, is in sort of an everyday, you know, hunting weapon, et cetera, et cetera. But we've heard a lot about the red flags and what was missed, and I do believe a lot was missed, and this is a case to be thoroughly studied to see, is there an aggregation of problems that should then lead authorities to do something significant with a person.
But aren't there cases where somebody shows a lot of red flags and goes through their entire life without ever doing something like this?
Yes, that is exactly right. And we have this whole problem of false positives, et cetera. So we're a long way, you know. In his case, I mean, he seemed to have been paranoid. There's a couple of instances that would indicate that. He does not appear to have been getting any kind of treatment that has surfaced that I know of, at least treatment for his mental state. And he had all these acting out behaviors, this impulse control problem. His own father talked about his anger expression and anger management problems. But, you know, in a constitutional society like we have, it's very difficult to do much. And then you have those folk who say, well, if there was more armed people at the time, this would have never happened. And on it goes. So we don't have a lot of these, thank gosh. We don't have a lot of these kind of things. But this one in particular, I think, really needs some, as the UW Madison slogan goes, winnowing and sifting of the evidence, because this is we have more information about this guy than we've had about many of these, and we need to study it closely.
We've got full phone lines, people answering some of the questions we threw out there earlier. Let's go to Jane in River West. Jane, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two brief comments. The first one is in response to the question about how the media, how I believe the media should handle it. And I believe that the best models are public television and radio, rather, because commercial television and radio are actually giving the public what they want, but unfortunately, with the 24/7 media frenzy, people are wanting all this moment-to-moment, be first, down to the grisly detail, lots of visuals. And in contrast, public media doesn't stop coverage of all other events practically, but maintains a balance, continues with the other big stories of the day, and does periodic updates. And I think that's a great, healthy balance for human beings.
Great. Thanks a lot for the call, Jane. Frank, a response to that?
Well, three cheers for public media.
I'll take it, yeah.
Absolutely. I love public media. But, you know, the commercial channels, et cetera, you know, we're not going to stop them from this kind of coverage. And their argument would be that the American people want it and they need it. I would just hope that they would become a bit more responsible in their reporting and throttle back a little bit on the negativity and, you know, produce some more positive images. I worry most about kids and kids who get exposed to all this stuff. You might remember in the aftermath of 9/11, I mean, I was advocating in the media that, you know, don't let your elementary school age kids see this stuff. You know, see that building going down and the screams and the people running. They don't need to know that. At an older age, yes, a limited amount of that, and discuss it and debate it and what it means to our society. And I would feel the same way for these sort of mass murders and et cetera. You know, like Sandy Hook shooting. I mean, we got a lot there. Thank gosh there was no video of it. But an awful lot of coverage, you know, that can scare the heck out of kids. So I think the commercial media does have to be a little bit more responsible and cut back a little bit on this coverage.
Jennifer writes on Facebook, there are so many mass shootings now, it made a small dent in my social media channels and in my immediate reaction. Whether that's burnout or what, I don't know. I keenly felt a lack of connection and empathy and horror that should have been evident immediately. It shames me, she writes, to say that, and yet it seems critical to acknowledge. Interesting reaction. What do you think, Fred?
Yeah. Well, she's sort of tuning into the numbing quality, you know, of the endless recounting of violence and horror in the media. And yes, some people do feel numbed and they don't respond. I mean, myself, I was driving down the main street in Philadelphia one day, and there was clearly a big police action going on. And I saw a policewoman running. She had a gun out and she was running, and other people were, and so on. And I mean, they weren't allowing you to stop, but I just sort of drove by and kind of looked at it and says, another, you know, criminal activity, and I went home. And so it's kind of easy to get numbed to this stuff.
We'll go to the phones again. Lori is with us in Stillwater, Minnesota. Lori, hi.
Hi. I wanted to make the point that when these situations come up, I think it's really easy for people to say, oh, it's another crazy, mentally ill person that has gone off with a gun. And for some of them, that is the case. But I think we all need to start asking the question of what kind of culture are we fostering here that brings about responses like this? It's happening more and more, and I would say that when you look around at how there's always money for wars and stadiums and, you know, bailing out big corporations and banks, but there's
Lori,
never
I'm gonna jump
money
in.
For schools.
I'm going to jump in because we don't have a lot of time left, but Frank, our culture fosters, it gives people maybe a script for a mass shooting as how you react to a situation. What do you think?
It could. It could. Sort of basically, crime has been going down a bit in the States, but not this kind of crime, not mass murders. And, maybe we are, you know, producing a script for more examples of this kind of thing, and therefore expect to see some more.
Just a quick, no time to go to the phones again, but Tim in Madison wonders, does the style of media coverage, how we cover these things, affect potential copycats? You were talking about copycats earlier, Frank. Briefly, is there a right way and a wrong way?
I don't think we know that. But if we had simply less lurid coverage, maybe that would, you know, downplay this for potential imitators. And we do know that some of people are looking for fame. That's sometimes a motive. And at least we could work on that by scaling back our coverage.
All right, Frank, thanks a lot for joining us. Always very interesting to talk to you.
You're welcome.
That's Frank Farley. He's a psychologist at Temple University, used to work here in Wisconsin, by the way, former president of the American Psychological Association.
Next is the news, and then we'll be back with a conversation on Wisconsin's controversial changes to estate tax.
You can always find out more about Central Time at the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR. And also, we're on that Twitter thing, Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.